Welcome to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, a senior editor at The New Yorker. We're 2 weeks away from the midterms, and things aren't looking good for the Democrats. It's a difficult political environment to campaign in. Inflation and gas prices are high, and Biden's approval rating is low. Far-right candidates are polling better than expected in races at every level of the government. The Democrats' majority in Congress was already narrow. Even a few flipped seats could dictate the future of reproductive choice and public trust in the electoral system, as many candidates still deny Biden's victory in 2020. Some of the most crucial races are extremely tight, with the leading candidates ahead by a percentage point or less. I hate to say that everything hangs in the balance, but everything kind of does hang in the balance. My colleague, Benjamin Wallace Wells, who has been following the midterms closely, joins me today to discuss what's at stake in November. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Tyler.
Thanks so much for coming on. I realize that this has been an extremely busy week for you. I feel like you've written more pieces this week than most writers write in their entire careers. So you wrote about the Pennsylvania Senate race, the Arizona gubernatorial race, and then you have a piece about the Ohio Senate race coming up, right?
That's right. Yeah, it has been busy, but it has also been super interesting.
So there are 435 seats in the House and 35 seats in the Senate that are up for grabs. What kinds of dynamics are you seeing in these different races?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to talk a little bit separately about the House races, the Senate races, and the gubernatorial races, because they do generally have somewhat different dynamics. The House races, you know, because the candidates are somewhat lower profile, you know, people might know a couple things about their congressman, but, you know, they might not be able to recognize them on the street. Those races tend to follow the general opinion of the president, you know, economic conditions, and the general opinion of the party. And there, everybody sort of expects that Republicans will win more seats than they did last time, that they will likely take control of the House. And over the last couple of months, sort of opinion has kind of ping-ponged between this is going to be, you know, a small but significant set of seats that go to Republicans. This will be a large set of seats that go to Republicans, basically dependent on like what the economic conditions and stories in the news are at the time.
Or how cynical you're feeling that day.
Exactly. The Senate is like a little different, though, because these are figures and candidates who have some national profile, who have the ability to raise a ton of money and to impose their own messages on the race. And the Democrats have been either savvy or lucky, but have in the key states, which here are basically, you know, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, have recruited candidates, some of them sitting senators, some of them challengers, who are really talented, who are about the best that Democrats can do. In general, you know, those candidates have not been campaigning with Joe Biden. They've generally sort of moved to distance themselves a little bit from Biden and his unpopularity. And so control of the Senate, even though we expect this to be generally a bad midterms for Democrats, is a little bit more up in the air and does hinge on like the ability of, you know, a few talented politicians to sort of make a way for themselves in a difficult political environment. And so those races have been especially interesting to watch. And then last of all, you know, the governor's races are interesting for a different reason, which is that it's a sort of funny thing, but the way that the COVID pandemic sort of played out politically meant that many, many governors, ranging from very liberal Democrats who are very strict about COVID to moderate Republicans who took a sort of, you know, middle path, to conservative Republicans who took a very, you know, open it all up, you know, kind of approach. Basically, across the board, sitting governors have seen a boost in their popularity and are proving sort of difficult to dislodge. And so there are more Republican governors and Democratic governors, but that is sort of a kind of unexpected and kind of interesting dynamic happening in the governor's races, too, where you often see sitting governors running, you know, considerably ahead of the Senate candidates in their own party.
Well, thank you for that. I feel like you may have answered all of my questions.
Just kidding. Sorry.
But no, that did explain a lot. I guess so there are a lot of pretty fascinating and competitive races this November. And I'm wondering, you know, which ones you're looking at the most closely.
Yeah, I think one way to think about this is just in terms of theme. You know, a big question after the Trump presidency as the kind of smoke from those wars has just started to drift away, is whether the Democrats still have a chance at winning working class voters around the country, and maybe particularly about whether they have a chance of winning white working class voters in the Midwest. In both Pennsylvania and Ohio, the Democrats have chosen Senate nominees who have personal histories and political approaches that are very rooted in a kind of older style of Midwestern Union Democrat. And that's Tim Ryan, a congressman from the Youngstown area in Ohio, and John Fetterman, who's now the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania in his state. And so I think that one question that has implications for politics beyond this cycle is whether those Democrats can continue to make a sort of beachhead in the working class upper Midwest, or whether we should think of those voters as just basically Republicans from now, even if they move from the Democratic column to the Republican column, basically with Trump and only a few years ago. And then, another set of regional questions comes in the Southwest and in races, concurrent races for governor and Senate in both Arizona and Nevada. These are places that have recently become more Democratic than they were. Arizona voted for the first time in a long time to give its electoral votes to a Democrat. It right now has two sitting Democratic senators. This is the state of, John McCain and Jeff Flake and Barry Goldwater. Arizona and Nevada are both under real pressure from illegal immigration, from immigration generally. It's a place where cultural change is felt very, very acutely. And they also are places that have had very aggressive factions of election deniers, people who have challenged legitimacy of the 2020 election and continue to seek ways of restructuring elections going forward to make it harder to vote, to benefit Republicans. And so in those states, I'm interested to see how Republican candidates have sought to channel those energies. And, I think the most effective example so far is Carrie Lake, who is a former TV host who is leading the race for governor. She's the Republican nominee in Arizona. But there are also examples of that in, different approaches, maybe a little bit less effective in the more mainstream traditional conservative candidate, Adam Laxalt, who's running for Senate in Nevada, and in a more Trumpy candidate, Blake Masters, who's seeking the Senate seat in Arizona. And then maybe last of all, I think that one thing that is often interesting about midterms is that you have candidates emerging who might lead their parties in the not too distant future. Ron DeSantis just shot onto the scene in 2018. Nobody had ever heard of him before. And I think in this case, in this cycle, the candidate who I've been most interested in from that perspective is Raphael Warnock, the senator from Georgia. He is in a tough race, mostly because of the political environment, with a flawed Republican candidate, Herschel Walker. But, I think that when I talk to Democratic political operatives around the country and other Democratic elected officials, they are very invested in his future, see him as a potential future leader of the party, and also worry that this election could cut off his political career. So in a more specific way, I'm also interested in that race.
How many Republicans in this election cycle seem to be running on 2020 election denial? You mentioned Carrie Lake, and Arizona is such an interesting situation. I think I'm just biased because I'm from there, but yeah. But I think, when everyone was really surprised when it went, for Biden, and Fox News called it, very early, before everyone else. It's so funny that they, went for Biden, and then it seems like they've spent all of the time since then trying to pretend like they didn't, yeah, or denying that they did, or maybe, yeah, this is what happens when you have a state that's kind of perfectly split.
Yeah.
The other side just can't possibly believe that, their neighbors might have voted in this way. But yeah, it seems like a really strange mixture of forces. And I'm curious about whether Carrie Lake is sort of the prime candidate right now who's running on the Stop the Steal thing, or whether this is a pretty common, unifying theme among Republican candidates this season.
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say it's pretty frequent that Republican candidates will at least pay lip service to the Stop the Steal movement. So they might they might say, I think there was fraud in the election, I have real questions about it, But there is a range in terms of how adamant they are that the 2020 election was stolen and how prominent it is in their rhetoric. There are a bunch of candidates, even kind of fringy ones like Don Baldick, the Republican nominee for Senate in New Hampshire, who have sort of gone back and forth. And in some of their media appearances said, you know, very directly, the election was stolen. And then in others, before different audiences, more mainstream audiences, said, oh, no, no, the election wasn't stolen. I think Carrie Lake sort of stands out as an example of somebody who has really continued to make this, you know, pretty central to her campaign. What exact authority she will have over reconstituting election rules in Arizona, you know, is a little beyond my technical understanding. But you have to imagine that if she is organizing the Arizona Republican Party around the idea that the election was stolen and that the things that led to the election being stolen need to be fixed, that there will be some changes before 2024 should she win. This is also something that comes up often in Secretary of State races. Secretaries of State usually have, you know, the oversight over administering elections. And their Republicans have been, and particularly, you know, right-wing Republicans have been pretty concerted and organized about nominating people who talk about the election being stolen all the time and see it as their mission to fix it. So, yeah, you're right that, like, something kind of opened up, you know, maybe in Arizona, maybe just generally in that kind of moment of back and forth on Fox News about whether the election looked legitimate or not. And I don't think it's stopping anytime soon.
Is it not self-defeating to run on a platform of the election was stolen? Like, does that not deter voters because, you know, people just assume that their vote won't be counted?
Huh, that's interesting. I mean, I thought you were going to go a different direction, which is to ask whether, you know, whether it deters voters because most people don't think that the election was stolen, you know? and I think the answer there is basically yes. I think it is not like a very good position for Republicans in most states to take. I think they may get away with it because, you know, the economy and the broader political environment are bad for Democrats. But I think also it does testify to their commitment to this, you know, like I think they are willing to run on this, you know, like somewhat like abortion, even in places where it's probably a losing issue for them. And to me, that in itself is interesting.
Hmm. What solutions are they proposing in terms of elections going forward?
I don't think that's really taken shape yet. You know, you have some election officials who are doing slightly crazy things, like proposing that they, you know, this happened in a county in Nevada, that they personally count all the ballots by hand, you know, after they've gone through the machines. Mm-hmm. There is this kind of rhetorical case that's made against voting machines. I had the Secretary of State in Wyoming, who's a Republican, but not an election denier, tell me that, you know, when he went to every public appearance, he made sure to bring a voting machine so that citizens could come up and disassemble it if they wanted and see that there was no bug or, you know, way of communicating with the internet inside, which is pretty crazy, you know. But like, you know, I think that basically this has mostly been a point of rhetoric. It's been a way of saying something terrible has happened in this country and I'm on your side in rectifying it.
And then it seems like some candidates, like, you know, Carrie Lake, for example, have already said that, you know, they won't commit to honoring the results of the election if they don't win, right?
That's definitely true. I wonder exactly what shape that will take, you know.
Yeah, I think Carrie Lake said something kind of like, I'm going to win the election, so, you know,
which,
it doesn't matter.
which is, there's been less pressure on this question in the past, but, like, that's a relatively common political formulation. It just was less prominent before Trump and mattered less. A lot of these races are really close. In Georgia, I think it's reasonably likely that we get a runoff, which is mandated there if neither candidate hits 50%. You know, but in many of these cases, we're probably looking at margins that look somewhat like the polls of 1-2 percentage points. And those are situations that are pretty ripe for challenges to the election. In the past, those have mainly taken the form of like protracted legal challenges and recounts and things like that. But it's possible that you could have a more active kind of street political set of protests around these elections, too. I don't think we're out of the woods on the election challenge or election denial situation at all. And I'm not even sure if candidates saying right now, of course, I plan to honor the results of the election. I'm not even sure if that's a great guide to what will happen, you know, on November 9th and 10th, if we do have extremely close elections, accusations of fraud, even just sort of the kind of normal level of uncertainty around close elections. I think it could be a difficult few days there.
We'll have more with Benjamin Wallace Wells in just a moment. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about the Pennsylvania Senate race, since there was a debate earlier this week that you wrote about. So in your column on the debate, you wrote that the debate between John Fetterman and Dr. Oz was uncomfortable, elemental, and a little surreal because of the contrast between two of the candidates. So I'm wondering if you could give us a bit of a recap for listeners who didn't tune into the debate.
Yeah, I mean, it was in many ways really moving. The background here is that Fetterman, the Democratic nominee, suffered a stroke in May, and it was a pretty serious stroke that took him off the campaign trail for a while and has meant that even as he's returned to the campaign trail in the fall, it's been in relatively managed situations. His campaign has said that he continues to have significant challenges with auditory processing, with understanding what is being said to him, and in clearly phrasing his responses. And, you know, he has made use of closed captioning technology, both on the campaign trail and in this case, on the debate stage to try to overcome that. There was a big question in politics in Pennsylvania, but just politics nationally, especially because this race is, you know, one of the couple that really probably will determine control of the Senate, about how he would look when he reappeared. And it was tough for him. The answers he gave to even straightforward questions tended to be a little bit confused. They were much simpler and less nuanced than he was able to be early in the campaign. And so this kind of basic human question of how healthy he was also ended up interacting with some of the more, you know, mundane political questions about, like, what he would say about Oz's attacks on him about crime, for instance, or whether he supported socialized medicine, sort of basic things that he might, in a different context, be more nimbly able to reply to and repel.
Do you think that it was a mistake for him to debate? I mean, I saw that, for example, in the Arizona gubernatorial race, that Carrie Lake's opponent, Katie Hobbs,
refused to debate.
Yeah. Debate. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I think this is a different situation in that there were so many questions about his health. The fact that he had a stroke was such common knowledge. He had to, at some point, make some demonstration of where he was. And I think that, you know, to credit his campaign and him a little bit, this is a crazy situation. And they have been very transparent about his deficit, you know, and when his advisors speak to reporters, they talk often about it. And the doctors who know stroke recovery say that he seems like on path to eventually being something like his full self, and that auditory processing is a specific thing that doesn't indicate cognitive deficits. But
if it were otherwise, I mean, if he'd had a stroke that was, you know, completely debilitating and it seemed like that was just going to be a permanent situation, I mean, I guess, did he have a choice to, like, you know, I guess not continue with the campaign? Or was it sort of like a, you know, I do this or Dr. Oz is a senator in Pennsylvania?
It's a great question. I don't know the technical answer. I do think that, you know, if the party could not find a way to replace him as nominee, that they could say, you know, if he wins, he will resign and the governor, you know, will appoint a replacement. That's a potential path. But then that depends on the governor's race, which is up for grabs right now, which a Democrat looks likely but not certain to win and might complicate that race, too. So I think it is sort of a tricky situation. I think also there just was a lot of uncertainty, having spoken to a bunch of his advisors around this time, even in the immediate aftermath of his stroke, about what his path back would look like. I think that just to take a step back here, you know, we spoke at the beginning about, you know, how much Democratic prospects rested on a very small group of pretty talented politicians who seemed like they, you know, might be able in certain Senate races to sort of win, even if the bulk of their state was sort of opposed to Democrats. Fetterman was very much one of those candidates. He was seen as pretty uniquely talented and able to pull together a coalition that other Democrats might not. And I think that is something that probably encouraged his decision to stay on the ballot. And, you know, I think this whole situation, which is hugely sad, just illustrates the enormous, enormous pressure that is on the shoulders of like a very few politicians and depends on very basic things like their health.
Absolutely. So just more broadly, I'm wondering if there are any political strategies that you've seen from the candidates that, you know, impressed you or that you were kind of surprised by. Like, I mean, it seems like, you know, as we spoke about earlier, you have a lot of Republican candidates who are denying the results of the most recent presidential election. But it also seems like a lot of Republicans are running on issues of crime, you know, inflation, that sort of thing. I mean, does that seem to be working for them?
Yeah, I think it does seem to be working. I think like one race that we haven't talked about that has been basically off the radar, but that is starting to seem very competitive, is the race for governor of New York. And there, the Republican Lee Zeldin, who was not previously seen as like a very talented figure, sort of a real Trump loyalist. He's a congressman from Suffolk County, from Long Island. He has been just beating the drum of crime in New York City, crime in the subways, day after day after day after day, and has started to come up very, very close in the polls to the sitting governor, Kathy Hochul, who took over after Andrew Cuomo was forced to resign. She was the lieutenant governor. She has not previously been a very charismatic or public figure and has some, I don't know exactly how to put this, but sort of some suggestion of scandal in her background. Mm-hmm. And that Zeldin has been able to, you know, so successfully just work the crime issue when crime in New York is not crazy compared to what it's been historically, up a bit, but not, you know, cataclysmic, it is pretty striking. And I think shows that, you know, you can look at candidates like Carrie Lake and say, okay, like this is a right-wing person who is clearly a political talent. Zeldin never struck people as like a great political talent, but he's been able to make use of the same issues very, very effectively. I think that the story coming out of August was that the Dobbs decision, the overturning of Roe versus Wade, had really changed the electoral landscape. And, you know, the kind of conversation shifted from issues that really favored Democrats, issues that favored Republicans. I think a big forensic question after this election will be what happened to the abortion vote. And maybe it still shows up. Maybe we have Democrats holding strong in suburban districts that we might think right now might be headed towards Republicans. But for a while, it looked like a real wave that would define this election. And then it just sort of stopped.
I mean, does it seem like Republicans are partly benefiting just from the, you know, sheer fact that they're not the ones who are in power right now?
Absolutely.
And so people are just kind of looking for an alternative? Because, I mean, it does seem like historically there has been sort of like a public narrative that Republicans are stronger when it comes to crime and to the economy and national security. And so I guess I'm wondering whether sort of that like widespread view among voters is being co-opted now or whether it's just, you know, whether there's like something else going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like as political reporters, we kind of go through this cycle every midterm where we start out and we say, you know, look, what determines outcomes in midterms is who holds the White House and how popular they are. And if the Democrat holds the White House and the president is unpopular, that's going to be bad for Democrats. And then we like spend the better part of a year sort of working through all these particular cases and noticing all these particular dynamics and characters. And we sort of like lose that narrative. You know, we lose that sense of just simple clarity. And then at the end, it kind of comes back a little bit. And you notice again, wait a second, like at the end of the day, the economy doesn't look very strong. The president is unpopular and the president is a Democrat. That looks like a pretty big win for Republicans. Maybe it's not so much more complicated than that. And, you know, I do think there's a lot going on that's like really fascinating in American politics right now. I think that, you know, Trumpism really altered both parties. And, you know, what we're seeing is new generations of leaders figuring out how to work within or try to reshape those structures. But, you know, if what we're trying to do is figure out who's going to win in the elections, I think that kind of basic analysis that says, you know, Biden's not very popular. He is the president. It's probably pretty good for Republicans. I think that's a pretty good place to start.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Sure, yeah. Take care.
Benjamin Wallace Wells is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he covers American politics. You can read his reporting on key midterm races on newyorker.com now. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Michelle Moses with help from Sydney Cobb. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thank you so much for listening.